This is Rosemary Hall, recording on behalf of the Dialect and Heritage Project for the University of Leeds. It's Thursday the 8th of September 2022, and can I ask you please to introduce yourself?
Sure, yes, I'm Julia Bishop. I live in Sheffield now. I am, golly, what am I, 62? And I was an MA student at the Institute of Dialect and Folklife Studies in Leeds in the years 82 to 83.
And how did you come to be involved in folklife?
Yes, I was. I'd sort of had a leisure interest in sort of folk song when I was growing up in Hastings. I used to go to the local folk club, which was called the Black Horse in Telham, which is just outside of Hastings. And but I did a music degree at Cambridge, a sort of straight classical degree. I carried on being quite interested in folk stuff there, and I made contact with the Cambridge Morris men and got to know a chap called Cyril Papworth in Cambridge. And despite the fact that the Cambridge Morris men didn't really approve of female Morris groups, I decided to start a female Morris team at Clare College, Cambridge, which I was attending. And Cyril was quite supportive of that, which was lovely. I also discovered that Cecil Sharp, the sort of turn of the century folk song collector, had attended Clare College, and his manuscripts were in fact in the library, though I didn't look at them at the time. So when it came to, I discovered I quite liked doing the research side. In my third year, I had to write a little dissertation, sort of historical, it was about 18th century music, but I discovered I loved doing the research side. So I was able, sort of thinking about doing postgraduate work, and one of my tutors said, well, why don't you branch into folk music studies? And I don't know how, but I'd heard that there were these folklore courses at a university in Yorkshire, and I failed to note which one, because I now gather there was one at Sheffield and one at Leeds. But the one at Leeds was the one that I found, and this was the Masters in Dialect and Folklife Studies. I did the Masters in Folklife Studies, and got in there to study there.
Did you have to do an interview?
Yes, I did an interview. I remember it quite clearly, actually. It was great. It was the tutors at the time were Stuart Sanderson and Tony Green. And I can remember the interview quite clearly. I went up to Leeds and, you know, it was a fairly conventional sort of interview, but quite relaxed and so on. And I remember Stuart had to go at one point. In fact, I think Tony sort of turned to him and said, oh Stuart, I think you've got to go now, haven't you? So I wasn't quite getting rid of him, but it sort of was, you know, giving him an opening to leave. So he went off. And then Tony sort of then just became very informal, just like, oh, well, I think I can tell you now, Julie, you've got in. So, you know, fancy going to the pub for a drink and we can talk a bit more informally. So we went off to the Eldon, which was sort of the pub around the corner from the English department, and had a drink and a chat there and talked about my interests and so on. So, yeah, it was a nice introduction.
What was it like to start the course?
Yeah, it was great, actually. Moved to Leeds. I didn't know Leeds at the time, but I very much liked, you know, I wanted to be in Yorkshire. I had a brother, actually, who lived in Lancashire at the time, so it was quite nice to be in the north. It was a bit different from being in Cambridge. And there were two other people on my cohort of the MA. There was a woman named Jean Rosling, who had been a classic student at Leeds. So she already had a bit of a circle of friends, I think, in the geology department, who were all staying on and doing postgrad stuff. So I tended to sort of mix with them and socialise with them. And there was a young man as well called Colin Neelands, and he was from Northern Ireland. And so it was just the three of us doing the course together.
Small cohort then.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, but we were, you know, we were varied. I think Colin's background was in English, so he was sort of quite textual. And I think his master's thesis was about broadsides in Ireland, maybe Belfast broadsides. Can't remember what Jean did with her background in classics. Don't remember that. Maybe something on narrative.
Yeah.
But folk song was my main interest.
Can you tell me a bit about how the course was structured?
Yes, as far as I can remember it, I should have looked this up. But I think there were like two, we would call them modules now, two courses in each semester. I don't even remember if we were on a semester or a termly system. But there was There was something about, obviously I remember this because it was my specialism, it was folk song and ballad. There was field research methods or research methods. There's something about the history of folk life studies. And I think there was one about material culture and that side of things. But there must have been more because, yeah, now it's coming back to me, there would have been custom. There was something about custom. Don't remember, perhaps it was three. I honestly don't remember. They were split between Tony and Stuart. I do remember that.
So there weren't any other tutors?
No, it was just the two of them. No, it was just the two of them. But we did get a bit of input from the chap who was kind of the technician in the archive, and I think he was called Reg. And I think he sort of did stuff with us on, you know, this is how a camera works, this is what an f-stop is. It was all pre-digital, of course. And I don't remember if we, yeah, I think we were sort of shown a bit of the archive, allowed into the room where it was and that sort of thing.
Do you have any idea how long the course had been going before you joined?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't, actually. But I did know that there were sort of various PhD students there or attached to there, that they weren't physically there. And I can't remember now whether I met them then or subsequently. There were... I just don't remember. I think it may have been... I then went to Newfoundland and did a PhD at the Department of Folklore at Memorial University. So it may have been since then, but I then met people like Teresa Buckland, who had done her PhD on the Britannia Coconut Dancers in Bay Cup, and done that at Leeds. And I think Michael Pickering, he'd done a PhD on Janet Blount, can't remember now, the folk song collector in Oxfordshire, and her manuscripts. And I'd also came to work on Jeanette Dunn's stuff. Now, Jeanette was from New Zealand and possibly, certainly, these people weren't in Leeds, but I was kind of familiar with their work and they were mentioned as part of the course.
Can you tell me more about your work with that collection?
Yes, well, I did my MA thesis about, well, it was based on Jeanette Dunn's field recordings, and also one commercial recording of the East Suffolk singer Bob Hart. He'd just died, I think, the year or so just before I took up the course. And Jeanette Dunn had visited him, I think, in the 70s. He was already in his 80s then. But, she'd made quite a few recordings for her PhD, which is about, sort of singing in East Suffolk generally. She worked a lot in that community. And I did about his singing style because I was really interested in the musical side of folk songs. Obviously, my background was in music. And I was able to transcribe by ear from the sound recordings that she had made of him singing. So I did these incredibly detailed music notations of his singing. I slowed them down, because we can slow down recordings now without losing pitch, but that wasn't possible then, so it was like, this growling sound, but I could kind of hear what was happening in between the notes, and sort of adapted conventional music notation to try and capture some of that, which is a bit like Percy Grainger would have done. It also touched a bit on the linguistic side, in that obviously how the words were pronounced and vocalised to make the melodic line, that was something that came into it. I did what's probably very, very light version of linguistics in order to get this. But I did use a bit of IPA to indicate how I saw him vocalising the words and how this impacted on the way he realised the melodic line. Anyway, this was my thesis. And based on Jeanette Dunn's field recordings. So that was great, and I was very much encouraged by them. They were very good, even though that wasn't a specialism, that musical side. Tony was very encouraging of all of that. And the external examiner was someone called David Buchan that year. He was, I think we had a little viva with David as well. He was Scottish, as his name suggests, and he was a very foremost ballad scholar at the time. And David was then the head of the department at Memorial University of Newfoundland. So that's, I think, basically how at the very last minute I was able to get a place there to go and study for my PhD.
Yeah, how did that feel?
What, to get the place? It was, well, it was funny actually, because I applied to various places. I applied to Edinburgh to do the PhD there, the School of Scottish Studies. I applied to Queen's University, Belfast, where they had an ethnomusicology programme that was headed up by a very, again, a very foremost ethnomusicology scholar called John Blacking. And I applied to Newfoundland, but I couldn't apply to Leeds because obviously Leeds itself was, you know, that at that time we all knew that was the last year. We all knew that this was the first of the cuts by Maggie Thatcher, and yeah, there was, you know, it wasn't going to continue, sadly. And you know, that was, it was such a good course. I was, yeah, it was a big you know, sort of disappointment that this should have to go. But I couldn't get any funding to study at Belfast or Edinburgh, and I think I'd pretty much given up on the, I was self-funded for the master's degree, and then I think I'd pretty much given up on the idea of going to Newfoundland. And then suddenly David must have got me a fellowship. It wasn't very much money at all, and I went really last minute. I can remember just sort of scrabbling around, shipping my stuff over there and getting the requisite visa, and you're supposed to have this money in your bank account, which I didn't have. I can remember my some sort of guarantee that I could get home again. So my sister and brother-in-law forwarded me this money just to show they could put it in my bank account if it was needed. And yeah, so I actually arrived late. I remember I don't think I even really knew properly where Newfoundland was, and just arrived a bit later than the start of the semester. So it was a bit of a sort of landing in the middle of a whole new place and new culture, really. And it was a great experience, but it was a bit of a shock to my system. I was still quite young and hadn't really travelled before. So this was, yeah, it was new. And the weather was cold and I didn't have enough warm clothing. And yeah, I adjusted, and it was great in the end. It was a fantastic experience.
Can you tell me a bit more about the atmosphere and the ethos in the institute?
Yeah, I mean, Tony and Stuart were very different from each other. I don't know how they got on, you know, professionally, but it always seemed fine. But they were very, very different. Tony was, well, no, let's start with Stuart. I mean, Stuart was, I think, quite sort of middle class. He was very well spoken. He was, you know, sort of straight Scottish, charming, very, but you know, sort of typical sort of academic in a way. It's totally personable and nice. Tony, I think, came from quite a working class background, and he was quite unconventional, I would say, in the way that he taught. He was great. It was like a breath of fresh air. I'd never had a tutor like him. So obviously our classes, there was only the three of us, so there was no point being in a kind of lecture theatre set up. Although I think we were actually, it's come back to me that for some of the lectures, I think we were with some of the undergraduates. And now I can remember that I can remember being in a room with some of the undergraduates, I think they were, having a lecture where Tony told us about, he was talking about the diachronic and the synchronic approaches, which must have come from a kind of linguistic background. But that as a way of, look, the two different ways of perhaps studying folklore. And you know, I've used this stuff over and over again in my own teaching. I just found it so, he did something about one of the problems with the wedding. If you study that diachronically, how there is sort of like huge gaps in the evidence. No, that's wrong. The history of something else, can't remember what, possibly Valentine's Day, actually. And he would just show us that there were these very different ways of, you'd get evidence and then there'd be a massive gap in the evidence, so you couldn't really tell if these things were connected because it was like hundreds of years gap. And so he was saying, this is one of the problems of studying it diachronically, and it's very interesting, but then you end up making these possibly outrageous and highly speculative connections. And then he did something synchronic, and it was about the white wedding dress, I remember, and how you'd think that was a really old thing, but actually, and he's talking about symbolism and the way in which these, you know, as, you know, sort of premarital sex has probably, you know, and living together and all that has increased the white wedding dress as a symbol, this was his argument, of virginity, was something that, you know, perhaps had become even more important, you know, to symbolise rather than to the actuality. It was a symbol of what you were supposed to be. And he brought in all stuff about rites of passage, and it was brilliant. So I do remember that lecture. I also remember he was a chain smoker, so I can, and this was obviously before the days it would have all been banned in the room, and I can remember him sort of pacing round and with his cigarette and holding forth, but it was highly engaging. It was, you know, it was good teaching. And then we had these seminars with him, just the three of us who were on the MA, and I can remember they were very informal and great, you know, and he'd provide coffee, you know, with a little kettle in his office, you know, and we would provide biscuits. I remember one time he joked that we were trying to make him sort of choke sort of while he was talking, or, you know, blow forth lots of biscuit crumbs. But so we had these small scale classes, and I remember him talking so, you know, just he was so able to extemporize on the topic. They were really first class. And I remember him talking about a particular song he'd collected as part of his own field work in the Calder Valley, and he was illustrating to us, you know, how important context was. You know, you can't just collect songs, you need to find out about the person and the social circumstances of the singing and what the song related to. And it was called I Am a Driver, and it was just a locally composed song, and the point was it just looked pretty innocuous on the page, like it wasn't particularly significant. And then he began to sort of talk about the whole sort of context of this guy being a miner, and how the pony, this was about his pit pony, and he talked about the word tubs, you know, what the tub was in the mine and so on, and how the ponies would pull these out, and tubs and rubs was one of the words, my pony rubs was one of the lines, and he talked about the, you know, the sores that the ponies would get on their back, and, you know, how this guy was sort of talking about his sort of, I think, concern, you know, for the animal, and it was just brilliant, and it just really brought the song to life, and obviously indicated the point that he was trying to make in the lecture about, or the seminar, about how important it was to go beyond and to interrogate the text with the person who was singing the song, really.
You spoke earlier about the closure of the Institute. Can you tell me more about what it was like at the time?
Yeah, I mean, I think it didn't impact on us too much. We knew, but I think I only sort of picked up later. I suspect that, and I don't know, and perhaps if you talk to Tony Green, you can sort of talk about how he felt about this. I felt there was some, well, there was more than regret. I think possibly bitterness. I don't know whether that's true. I never spoke about it with Tony. But I remember he went straight away to, as far as I knew, to get another job. Well, he had a wife and family to sort of support, I knew. So he went to Bretton Hall, which was a teacher training college at the time, and moved to there. And Stuart, I think, I don't know if he retired then or just moved to the School of Scottish Studies. So in a way, I think Tony perhaps moved out of, you know, sort of higher ed and research and so on. Whether there was a feeling that perhaps Stuart could have done more, I'm just guessing. I don't know. But looking back, obviously, with the benefit of hindsight, we know that Margaret Thatcher was quite keen on saving money and all the rest of it. So perhaps was going to be a losing battle, whatever, because there were more closures. It wasn't just us.
So can you say a bit more about what your sense was for the reason of the closure?
This sounds a bit like I didn't know. I'm trying to think. It was just part, I think, of some, you know, Thatcher cuts, was as I understood it. There must have been need to, I don't know, to make savings at the time. And I went out of the country immediately after that, so I don't really think, I think I sort of missed a lot of of all of that sort of thing. So maybe the real reason why it was cut, but obviously, you know, folklore studies, and this was something we covered in the course, folk life studies, it's never flourished in England. One of the points Tony made in one of his lectures was, you know, he said the only departments of folklore, folk life that you've got in the country, they're both in the north. I don't think there's any, you know, he said, I don't think that's a coincidence, you know. And he talked about, you know, the whole idea of, obviously, folklore studies very connected with kind of colonialism. And he's, one of the reasons he said was, you know, maybe it's the fact that you know, we were successful in the imperial endeavour, and England was, and that's perhaps why we don't value our own stuff or have the same feeling about it. If you've been oppressed, of course, if you're Scottish or Irish or, you know, Eastern European, then you, you know, you put lots of money into the study and the preservation of your cultural heritage.
That's really interesting. How did your MA at Leeds influence your later career?
Yeah, it was, as is probably obvious, you know, it made a big impression of me, and I knew I wanted to go forward and study. So I think I've already mentioned this time around about David Buchan being the external examiner. So I went to Newfoundland, did a PhD there. I didn't stay for the whole 3 years of the PhD programme, but I did stay for 2.5 years, and then I came back as part of an exchange that existed between the folklore department there and it was the Centre for English Cultural Tradition and Language then, SECTAL, and then it became the National Centre for English Cultural Tradition in Sheffield. That was obviously the director and founder of that was John Widdowson, and John himself obviously had all these connections with Leeds, and quite a few of the students, again PhD people who'd been at done things at Sheffield also had links to Leeds. So I suppose, yeah, we were all connected, and I met Clive Upton through John Widdowson at Sheffield. But obviously I've carried on in my interest in folk song. Someone in Newfoundland called John Ashton, who was at Wilfrid Grenfell College in Cornerbrook. He was in charge of the folklore programme there. It's an offshoot of Memorial University in St John's. He also was a student of Leeds, originally from Barnsley. I knew John well. It was a connection I felt to people. And when I came back to this country, after being in Newfoundland, I became part of the, you know, community of people who were sort of advocates of folklore studies, both as part of the Folklore Society and as part of the English Folk Dance and Song Society, and particularly Folk Music Journal, which was then, the editor was Ian Russell, who did his PhD at Sheffield, but again was obviously very aware of people like Mike Pickering and others who'd worked at Leeds, Jeanette Dunn and so on. And I became, and Teresa Buckland, who was a PhD student, and I met them through Ian and being on the board of the journal and through conferences that took place. So in a way, I mean, you know, looking back, it was really my passport, my credentials in a way to becoming one of the community of folk song scholars and perhaps more widely folklore scholars in this country.
How aware were you, Julia, when you were doing your MA of the archival materials that would later become the LAVC?
Yes, I mean, I think we were probably introduced to them as part of the course, the sort of research methods would have touched on. And this is unique to folklore studies, I think, that, and probably dialectology studies, that, you know, that you preserve, you'll get your students to do fieldwork, and then you preserve those. It's something I'm encountering very much now. You know, it's of course, it's taken on a whole lease of life. It's natural to us, or not natural, but it's taught to us, isn't it, that that's what you do. It was the same in Newfoundland. There was always an archive attached to a folklore and language department. And, so as part of our training was to preserve the stuff, whereas now it's like this is a whole new thing in higher education. Oh yes, you preserve the stuff, you don't delete it at the end, trying to persuade colleagues that this is actually historically an amazing thing. To preserve it is something else now. But at the time we did a little bit of work in the archive. I don't know if we actually did any work with recordings. We did at Memorial. I remember we had a little archive internship. That's how we earned a little bit of extra money, and we had to, so we got a little bit of archival training. But I was definitely introduced to, you know, sort of the cataloguing records and how to use the archive. And I don't remember a huge amount about it. I can sort of remember being in the room and stuff like that. There may have been someone who was an archival assistant there. I can't remember who that was now. But it was Reg who provided me with these field recordings of Jeanette Dunn, so I guess I never really used it at the time. But much later, I met Robin, who you're going to interview later this morning, and he was, I met him at Sheffield who was volunteering at NatSect, and then he got the job, I think, being an employee on the grant that Clive Upton had to digitise some of the establishment of the LAVC as distinct from the IDFLS, isn't it such a mouthful, archive.
So you mentioned Clive before, is that how you came to know him, through Robin?
It was actually through John Widdowson at the centre. I did know Clive first. Clive was around. I can't remember. I didn't know Clive too well, but he definitely bobbed in from time to time at Sheffield, because even after I finished my PhD in Newfoundland, I just began to sort of be a volunteer, really. I did a little bit of teaching, evening classes and that sort of thing, because it really was the only place in the country that had anything to do with folklore. So in my mum's words, I probably never got a proper job. And eventually, much, much later, I became a researcher in the School of Education after the closure of the NatSect, and that all went under. It was around the time I had my family, so I wasn't really doing much in the sort of research department, as it were. And then I was very fortunate to come back to the University of Sheffield around 2009, when our eldest was about 9 years old and our younger two were sort of early years. And they had a research position in a project that was touching on the Opie collection. Their field recordings, I never even knew the Opies had made recordings. I thought it was all written stuff. And they needed a research assistant, and the wife of a friend had heard about this and said, "Julia, I think this is up your street, why don't you apply?" So I did, and I don't think they knew, it was in the School of Education, I don't think they realised they needed a folklorist until later, but obviously I fitted the bill. And I've been very fortunate that since then they've just become really keen. It seems to be very allied with their sort of educational interest in children's cultural worlds, the new literacies approach, new media, children's own cultural production. This is all seen as very allied now to children's folklore studies. So in fact, I still work, that was in 2009, and I'm still there on a kind of the odd research contract.
Wow. And through being with Robin, how have you become familiar with the LAVC?
Oh, yes. Well, that's a sort of tie-up as well. Obviously, so the chronology is that Robin, well, remember the year, it was sort of in the early 1990s. We had the World Student Games in Sheffield. I was still working on my PhD because I actually took about 10 years to complete it. And by this time, my funding had run out from Memorial, so I was just kind of hanging around teaching music lessons privately, and because I had that good old music degree and I was a practitioner, so that's how I earned my living. But I was kind of volunteering a bit in the archive at NatSect, and John Widdowson wanted to put on an exhibition for the World Student Games based on the holdings of the NatSect archives and about the work of NatSect, and obviously it's time to sort of talk about traditional culture. So Rob came as a volunteer to the centre, and I met him that way. And then we sort of kind of got together. Subsequently, though, there was this position to work on the LAVC through that grant. And at the time, so he then began commuting to Leeds. I think, I can't remember when that position started, but we might have been married by then. And just prior to that, I had been working on the collection. Oh, yes, maybe I had got employment at this stage at Sheffield, but I'd been working on the collection of James Madison Carpenter, which is a folk song collection that was made in Britain in the 1930s by Carpenter, who was actually an American scholar. And it was at that time quite inaccessible. It was held at the Library of Congress. It was on microfilm, but nobody had done too much with it in this country. And everyone said, "Julie, you know, this is a great research opportunity. Why don't you do something with it?" So I may have got my chronology all over the place here. Sorry. So I met Robin in the early 90s, but this would have been in the early 2000s when the LAVC thing got going. Anyway, to cut a long story short, and why I'm mentioning it is because we were recommended by another person kind of in the folklore world called Michael Heaney, who's at the Bodley, he was at the Bodley and in Oxford, but very interested in Morris dance. He recommended using encoded archival description for the work that we did on the Carpenter collection. We got some funding, AHRB as it was in those days, Resource Enhancement Scheme, and so we used EAD in our description of the Carpenter collection, which was digitised by the Library of Congress for us to work on. And from that, I think that's how that became to be used in the LAVC project then, to catalogue the some of the holdings of the LAVC. And someone on our team, on the Carpenter team called Bob Walser, then was engaged, I think, as a bit of a consultant to produce the, I think it's called a cascading style sheet or something, which then enabled the online presentation as it was then of the catalogue and what had been digitised of the LAVC recordings.
Wow, so there are a lot of connections between your work.
There's so many that I think I'm probably getting them in a muddle, but you'll be able to unravel them later.
Through being married to Robin, do you have an interest in dialect?
Well, Rob was, he comes through a kind of heritage management and sort of local history backgrounds. So neither of us, I think, particularly specialise in dialect. But obviously, through Rob, I did meet Johnny Robinson. And through my work, particularly, I would say, in children's play, I'm really quite interested in the sort of the language side there. And I know Johnny is as well. So that's part. I mean, the thing about a folklore degree is it's just fantastic because I did all aspects of folklore. So I've done some like material culture, I've done a bit of language, I've done a bit of song, I've done a bit of custom and belief and anthropology. It's such an eclectic sort of mix, which back then, again, Tony said, I remember he used that word eclectic, you know, and he said, you know, maybe it's not a bad thing, but it's not well looked on, you know, history at the time, oral history. I think they thought the folklorists were sort of, you know, also rans in the oral history department. We didn't do history properly, and oral historians themselves were a bit sort of out of it as regards the sort of history departments, who were, well, perhaps a little bit more hidebound, shall we say. But so I suppose I'm a dabbler. I wouldn't say that, yeah, but I am. I'm really interested in the language, and I suppose, but I'm typical and I probably just notice stuff that's most different from my own. But obviously the Opus did those incredible maps in their books of, you know, children's truce terms and the terminology for, you know, the person who's on and it. And I've used those again and again in teaching, and obviously I'm working with the OP materials, the OP archive now, and it's wonderful to see, you know, how that, you know, was represented at the time in their materials.
If I can ask a really broad question, how would you describe the study of folklore developing over the course of your career since that MA?
Oh gosh. I suppose at the time I came back, so I was finished my MA in 83 and I went to Newfoundland from 83 to 86. I came back in January 86. I then, I've been in Sheffield ever since then, basically. I was really kind of working through the societies, we all were. So the Folklore Society and the English Folk Dance and Song Society were the sort of the areas where I was meeting other scholars. Well, that's not true. And there were all sorts of groups. There was like the traditional drama research group from out of Sheffield and so on. So that brought me into contact with sort of like Paul Smith and Georgina Boys. And at the time, I think those, that generation, Gillian Bennett, Marion Bowman, Steve Roud, they'd all kind of decided they were going to get folklore studies going, and they were doing it. They'd gone onto the committee of the Folklore Society. They were part of the something called the Academic Services Committee, I think, of English Folk Dance and Song Society. And they were really trying to raise the profile of the academic study of folklore and folk song through these means. But I don't know, it has continued, but there are no more. I mean, there's a now an initiative at Hertfordshire, I think, a sort of master's in folklore. Sheffield Hallam, John may have mentioned this, John Widdowson, doing stuff in folklore. So there are sort of risings from the phoenixes from ashes. But in some ways, it's John became, and Sheffield just became the lone voice. And Robin and I were there at the, as NatSect sort of, you know, began to be closed down, really. And it wasn't a pleasant time. It was a difficult time then. And we tried to advocate, but that wasn't well received. And no, it was really difficult, I would say, to see the demise of NatSect, to see the archive go into the special collections. I mean, it has been preserved. But, you know, that the university didn't value it, we felt. And it was a shame. I was then trying to continue my research into the Carpenter collection. Sheffield didn't really want to have that. And I was, in the end, taken over my position, and the whole project's really moved to the Elphinstone Institute at the University of Aberdeen, where Ian Russell, it's all such a small world, who was living in Sheffield, who'd done his PhD at NatSect Ensemble, but was definitely familiar with all the folksongy people from Leeds. He then became head of the department at the Elphinstone Institute, which a position which was previously reserved for David Buchan, but David got cancer and he was only in that position for a very short time before he died.
So how exactly did that come about, the closing down of NatSect, and why?
I think it was, I can't remember all the ins and outs now, and John perhaps would have spoken to this better. It was always seen, I think, as John Widdowson's baby. And it was always seen as, and it was language and folklore. And, you know, we got the students, he taught the undergrads, it was brilliant, we got all their projects, we got some fantastic information and archival materials. There's loads of stuff about children's folklore, for example. They love that, the students. And so now there's so much information sort of post the OPIs and pre any of the work we did. And, you know, there was a PhD by someone called Mavis Curtis that's done for, that's absolute gold dust now, because it's all pre-digital. And of course the impact of the digital on children's play, you know, but it's all pre that time, just before that time. Fantastic amount of information. So, but of course folklore studies as a discipline, it was always seen as a bit of a, perhaps a, I don't know, it was a bit of a joke discipline. So it was neither fish nor fowl. It was John's language research, again, was very important and very, you know, sort of very much contributed, but it just never quite got a foothold and it never achieved the status. And I think as John was seen as coming up to retirement, there was this, it seemed to me, you know, this kind of, millstone of the archive, if you like, this physical thing that was there. So it needed a lot of housing. And even though we were bringing in research funding a bit and that sort of thing, it was, universities were changing very much, weren't they, at that time. And, you know, I think it just didn't fit the new ethos, really. And it felt very much so there was a move from the very top to get it, you know, sort of to finish it. And so there was interviewing for a new director, and that was a series of very uncomfortable moments. I remember Paul Smith was interviewed. He would have been John's obvious successor. Paul had been in Newfoundland, but I don't think the things that he was saying went over well with those who were judging. So the new person who took over was Joan Beale. But it seemed to me, I'm obviously she's a dialectologist and so on, but it seemed to me she had been asked to preside over the closing of the centre. That's how it appeared. And unfortunately, Robin and I really sort of fell out with Joan, and it was a difficult relationship. Yeah, it was unfortunate and it wasn't intentional, but perhaps structural at the time. We were seen as agent provocateur, I think, really, in our efforts to try and save NatSect, really. So, yeah, it was a difficult relationship. And so then Rob went on to work at Leeds, and, yeah, I I had a family, and about the same time lost one of our children when our children died, so it was just not a good time. So basically, yeah, we just kind of, you know, became detached from all of that, and I felt really sad about it. You know, it was really, it seemed to spell the end of folklore studies. But, you know, we have some students that were master's degree students and PhD students, some of whom, I mean, one of them was a young woman called Kath Bannister. She now is one of the researchers in the School of Education at Sheffield that I work with. So some of them have gone on and been able to find a foothold, but they're in different departments, and few people do something that is called folklore. It's not consolidated.
How would you like to see things in the future?
Well, of course, it would be lovely if there was a folklore department and it had the recognition and could somehow bring together all of these, you know, all this, you know, there's these incredible archival resources at Leeds and at Sheffield. I mean, there's, again, there's children's folklore stuff I'm really interested at Leeds. It would be fantastic to be able to access that stuff and to work collaboratively. It would be really great to be more in touch with all the departments across the different, well, the different kingdoms of the United Kingdom and Ireland. You know, it would be great because, I mean, Steve Rowd and I have started an informal group, the name of which I'm not going to get right, but it's something like the Federation of Folk and Traditional Music Archives, for example. And we're just talking to each other. We're talking to ITMAR, the Irish Traditional Music Archive, and UCD and School of Scottish Studies in Aberdeen, and all the Welsh folk as well. And it's like we've all got these holdings, you know. And I think about the way in which the resources there for teaching. But really, I think it's only folklore studies, and I would, you know, I'd like to see it married up to the dialect side as well. But I think these, it only kind of makes sense in that context. It's useful for other things. It's useful historically and sociologically and anthropologically and all these things. But I think it is in the eclecticism of folklore studies. It just doesn't, of course, it has a foot in all these different faculties, social sciences, humanities, what have you. But I would really love to see, I've thought in the medium term, sort of some sort of online course. There's so much interest. And, you know, see material heritage, huge potential for public engagement, huge digital potential for AI, AR, VR, huge potential, obviously, for crowdsourcing and co-curation of materials, co-research. There's a lot of potential, and we're certainly at Sheffield trying to work on that in relationship to the Opie collection, and with my colleagues in Aberdeen, similarly for the Carpenter collection, and indeed the folk songs more generally, you know, the Vaughan Williams Memorial Library digital archive as well. You know, there's so much stuff online, but what do we do with it, and how do we engage people with that? But also, it goes back to that contextualisation that I was mentioning about with Tony. I'm all for songs being performed. It's fine. It's a new generation of singers. But what with Steve Rowd, who's published a book and or many books in fact, but you know, who's very much, you know, sort of an advocate of this. I don't want this stuff to be plucked out of its sociocultural context, its historical context. It was of its time, and yes, it persisted through time, but that doesn't mean it wasn't recontextualised every time it was learnt and sung and so on, and the role it played in people's lives. I think that's incredibly important, that we don't falsify the history of it by liking it in our present-day circumstances and reviving it. And, you know, so I'm very much for understanding it from a kind of historical point of view as well, and indeed for contemporary research. Contemporary, what is folk song today? You know, it's definitely, I think, what's happening in playgrounds. We saw a lot of it on YouTube, perhaps, in the pandemic, parody, that sort of thing. So I think informal vernacular song cultures go on, and I'd love to see that continuing to be preserved and part of that remit of what I would see as folklore and language studies now.
Julie, you've given me so much of your time. I'm so grateful. Is there anything else you'd like to tell me about that we haven't talked about?
I don't think so, but I'm absolutely sure the minute you switch on the recording, I will remember it. I can certainly provide you sort of with names and contact details of quite a few people who would have been involved at Leeds, some of whom sort of a little bit the generation before me, and some of my cohorts at Leeds, if that would help.
That would be wonderful.
Thank you. Yes, I'll definitely look those out. And yes, I'm absolutely sure. I can't think of anything at the moment, so let's say no is okay. The answer to that question. But
That's
thank you
great.
Very much.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
It's
been
a pleasure,
real,
Rosie.
Real privilege.
Yeah, good luck with the project.